But so I wouldn't put a lot of stock in, you know, somebody like, you know, Dan Brown or even this guy Moore saying, yeah, I hated it. You know, that could be a lot of, you know, hype as well.
Yeah, it could be, absolutely. Who knows?
You never know. You really got to know more personal details about it.
Sure. And in the end, I mean, that doesn't matter because it's the message of the, you know, the movie.
Well, it's kind of unlikely, isn't it? I mean, the director, when you're commissioned to do a story like this, you have a lot of say in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
When you're working with a scriptwriter, you pretty know much what the movie's going to be. So I'm very suspicious that later on, just after the real shooting starts, that it could diverge so far from your script and your storyboard that you might not like it in the end and want to take your name off it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, writers are pretty much involved a lot right up to the moments when the cameras start rolling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And many writers have even said, hey, I want a cameo in the movie. You know, my agent has said, you know, not only have I written the script or co-write the script and have all the rights of the script, but I want even a little cameo in the movie, you know, and many studios have even done that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that you do have a lot of rights and you do have a lot of legal protection.
Yeah.
So later on when I hear about this kind of thing where I had to withdraw my name because I just hated the way it came out, that can only happen if, you know, you've lapsed in your rights and they've literally made a movie absolutely without you. Right? Like, you know, the rights of your script has lapsed.
Yeah.
And some studio has taken your idea. You know, this happened with Robert Crumb, the great American cartoonist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he had no money, so he'd create all these incredible things like Felix the Cat and whatever. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, some Disney had made a whole cartoon. Mm-hmm. Well, his name's not on it. It's got nothing to do with him. And then people still going, you know, I hated that Felix the Cat cartoon that Disney made. Man, you shouldn't have ever done that. He turns around going, well, I was not even involved in it. What are you blaming me for?
Yeah.
So, you know, again, we've got that. So, yes, sure. Obviously a person can say, I hated that movie that was made of my book or my name.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Christopher Tolkien basically gave the kudos to, you know, Peter Jackson and said, yes, our family support your script and what you've done.
Mm.
You know, because they have total rights. He could not have made that movie without the Tolkien family say so.
Mm-hmm.
And they totally were behind the film. So, you know, in that case, everything went well. But,
yeah.
But if you've been involved in it, you know, I mean, you've got the rights.
Sure.
You know, that's a different story.
Mm, it is, yeah. So, I mean, beyond that, do you want to say something more about V or want to move on to Fight Club?
It's, you know, there's so many elements to that movie. We'd spend the whole hour just talking about it, you know.
Yeah.
It's very deep. I want people to really go and look at it, as a psychological drama that it's based on this person finding their identity. In movies, there's a lot of missed fathers. Fathers that are missing. You get this in the Fight Club, where there's a hole. I mean, the movie can almost be entirely analyzed from the point of view in Fight Club of the missing father.
Yeah,
you definitely got that in Hellboy. You've definitely got that in V for Vendetta. So if you come to it from a female point of view or feminine psychology point of view, then the movies are very, very interesting about the interplay of the archetypes. You know, and again, we'd spend the whole hour getting into that, so people need to listen back to our shows on that or on The Outsider and the whole concept of authentic life.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and how you break from that, and that breaking from the inauthentic life, just like we were saying with the prisoner, you know, the prisoner tries to escape. I think that's a very, very profound story of escape, not just from family and not just from the normal programming, but from totally the whole corporeal matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the big ball comes in, you know, Rover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Rover in the prisoner, the big ball, a lot of people have been, you know, speculating what that really represents. Rover is made of two words, roll over, right? And rolling over or going past brings up a lot of fear. So to me, Rover is fear.
Mm.
All right, so when people are watching, in fact, when Rover ever appears, it always appears when there is an emotion of fear. Now, McGoohan never explained what Rover was because he wanted to leave it as a random element in his program. But I believe that Rover is human fear. Because as anyone who tries to leave the village, right, Rover comes and catches them, right?
Yeah, sure.
But if you look at it in a different way, anybody who tries to leave the village gets prevented from doing so, not by an agency, because Rover is just a big ball, a big balloon.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like he's saying it's not there at all. There's no physical agency, there's no army, there's no barbed wire, but you don't leave the village. It's because you won't walk past it because of your own fear. And Rover, to me, the thing that drags them back or brings them back or accompanies them back like this watchdog is really people's own trepidation and people's fear.
Yeah.
You see this picked up in the first scene of Lord of the Rings where Sam stops at the boundary of Hobbiton.
Mm-hmm.
As they're leaving on their great journey, the great mythical journey, he literally stops and says, and Frodo goes, why have you stopped? And Sam goes, because if I move one more step, I'll be further than I've ever been in my life from my home, from my village.
Yeah.
And of course, he takes the step, and that is what is powerful about that film. He does take that step.
Hmm.
And many people in this world, many millions of people in this world, will not take that step, physically or, and more importantly, psychologically.
Hmm.
Now, V for Vendetta, you see, reverses back to this, that here you have a society, just like the village, in which there is no chance of physical escape. It's wall to wall. It's just, you know, a Blade Runner existence. Absolutely left has met right, right has met left, east has met west, and west has met east. There is no escape in this particular, you know, penitentiary corporate existence. And we're hurtling towards that now in our own world.
Yeah.
However, the message of V for Vendetta is, are you free in your mind? Because that's where real freedom is.
Mm. Yeah.
Don't expect it to ever come collectively. Don't expect it to ever come as some concerted effort. It, you know, probably has never happened, and it will not happen, and it certainly will not happen in the large, you know, city, metropoli, corporate environments that we have.
Yeah, yeah.
So the message of V is very much one of psychological freedom.
Hmm.
You know, psychological freedom, and this is, again, a key that I really do like about that film.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Again, it's a classical theme, I guess, in that sense, kind of going through the dark night of the soul, or whatever you want to call it, and then emerge from that, you know, with a sense of freedom that you have, you know, you have to go through the dark periods in order to, you know, get to know yourself and stuff like this.
And that's right. You will project your shadow onto an ambivalent character that enters into your life. And in Hellboy, which I believe is a very superior movie, and that's why it's one of my personal favorites, is that the female figure in that, and it's not only female figures who go through underworld cycles, obviously, that's good for dramatic effect.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the men go through it as well, because what we're really talking about here is masculine and feminine processes, and not male and female.
Sure.
You know, I mean, Henrik, I have got emails from people saying, we hate the way that you, you know, talk so much about the female,
mm-hmm.
and that you're anti-androcentric, you know,
mm-hmm.
you are darning the male energy in a lot of your work.
Oh, okay.
I mean, literally, you know, I mean, I read this because I'm interested in critics.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I read everything my critics say.
Mm.
I don't read it if they're abusive, but if they have criticalness, you know, I will listen to what they say, because it's very, very important.
Yeah.
As me as a public figure to, you know, and I'm trying to give a message to the world or whatever, to really listen back to the feedback.
Yeah, sure.
And not a lot, but sometimes I've been hit with that, wait a minute, you know, you're talking so much about the goddess and the feminine female qualities, you know, we don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I respond back to that going, look, you know, I'm not talking about the female, I'm talking about the feminine.
Exactly. Something we all got.
Yeah, I'm no fan of men and women.
Mm.
I'm, you know, that's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Men are just as bad. Women can just be as masculine and crazed out and you know, as ludicrous as the men.
Sure.
You're all in the same, you know, mess.
Yeah.
Each person projecting their own garbage onto another. What I'm dealing with is fundamental meta themes that go beyond that. And of course, this is, you know, not understandable by a lot of people. So again, I have to emphasize that feminine does not mean female. There's a feminine aspect of the masculine. There's a masculine aspect of the feminine.
Sure.
Of the female.
Yeah.
Of women. And people really need to get into this. You know, man has breasts. He has nipples, doesn't he?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. There's a female aspect within the male.
Yeah.
You know, women have body hair.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and a clitoris. That's, you know, let's face it, there are aspects of both sexes there. But when you go on to another level higher than that, then you're into the symbolic canon. And that's what these filmmakers are drawing upon, is the symbolic canon. They're not just there to reinforce the prejudices of the street level, you know, local yokel. And in these movies, there's a very deep dialogue about this. Not perhaps as complex as the one in the Mummy movie, the original Mummy we were talking about.
Mm.
Not perhaps as complex as in John Berman's Zardoz, or as complex as you might find in some of Alfred Hitchcock's movies, like Vertigo, or even in Werner Herzog, who I think is an exceptionally complex, you know, has some very complex interactions dealing with the feminine principle.
Mm-hmm.
But still, these are movies that are harder to find. Most people are familiar with the bigger movies.
Sure.
And in V for Vendetta, you do find this great interaction with the shadow archetype.
Mm, yeah.
And the woman has the choice then at the end to either project all her anger and hate onto V, who's put her through this terrible ordeal in which she thought she was going to die.
Yeah.
You know, she was imprisoned. There's no reason why she should like that experience. And then when she finally awakens and finds out, oh my God, this was a hallucination.
Hmm.
She responds with terrible anger towards him.
Yeah.
That's displaced anger, you see, from the original father, the missing father.
Hmm.
And then she transcends, because in effect, she doesn't, in the end, you know, respond or run away or get, you know, off the track.
Sure.
Doesn't rush back to the comfort zone. And that's why that movie succeeds, in my eyes, as a very transcendent film.
Mm.
One of a kind.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and in Fight Club, you have the whole critique of the masculine. It's probably one of the most complex movies, you know, that's been made in recent times. Again, I encourage people to go and read the original book, of course. But it's a very transgressive movie, and I like transgressive films, you know, all the way down the line. And transgressive is the opposite, you see, of these conformist kinds of films.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you watch a lot of Alfred Hitchcock movies, you will notice that he did a bit of both, because, again, like any great artist, he was a very ambivalent character. But in a lot of his movies, the status quo is always restored.
Mm-hmm.
People watch the movie The Birds,
mm-hmm.
and they watch it from a psychological point of view, you will find that it's a very pro-establishment, pro-status quo film. And a lot of Alfred Hitchcock, because he worked for major studios and he was sort of himself, I believe, quite, you know, I think he had some very conservative, misogynist, you know, and okay, this is all debatable again, you know, but
mm-hmm.
there's one aspect of looking at Hitchcock's movies that are very establishment pro,
mm-hmm.
if you watch what's really being said subliminally. And then you have these transgressive, you know, directors like Herzog and Wenders and Fassbinder and many others in the West,
mm-hmm.
who are not, you know, like that. They're talking about the deconstruction. Well, Fight Club goes to the extreme of saying, look, your whole society is basically in a death, you know, cycle.
Yeah, on a death row, yeah.
Yeah, and people are not happy anymore. I mean, the prime characters are no longer happy with the roles that they're playing within this framework of what society is given. And that is very common because that is what's happening now in the world. All this so-called homosexuality and transsexualism that you've been seeing in the world for the last 20 years, that's got nothing to do with sexual proclivity at all.
Yeah.
The whole gay way and all that stuff, what that really has to do with is the fact that subliminally, on a subconscious level, people know that you're in this sort of desert, that God probably doesn't exist, and if God doesn't exist, then heaven probably doesn't exist. And if heaven doesn't exist, probably hell goes with that as well.
Mm.
So all you've got then is the world and other human beings to rule over.
Mm, yeah.
But if you really think about it, and this is one of the messages of Fight Club and transgressive movies, it's also a very common theme now in the modern age, is that, wait a minute, if God really doesn't exist, and then you can immediately say that heaven and hell does not exist, then what is there to rule over to feel power?
Mm, yeah.
So the Bush people and all of these politicians go, well, we already know that God is dead. We just mouth a lot of Christian jive, but we know, of course, we know in our hearts that the only way to turn life on and to be living is, and the only way to get your kicks is to rule the world and the people in it as slaves. Then, as I said in the Future of Mankind video, you've got the opposite instinct to that. I'm going to rebel. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be ruled by others, and I don't want to rule others myself. And then comes the transgressive, rebellious aspects. But the thing with that, Henrik, is this. In a situation in which God is dead, God always represents the Father, and that's what Fight Club is so much about, is the missing Father again. And, of course, if you're a Christian, then, you know, you're absolutely, God is the Father. Your Father, you worship your Father, you respect your physical Father. There's nothing wrong with that. And you also represent the President. All of these father images in the place of that God. But if the father is missing, for some reason, your own physical father, and there's even lines within the Fight Club that talk about the missing father.
Yeah, sure. I remember.
If that father is gone, then you have a psychological response known as antipathy or hatred towards the object of your hate. You know, you have antipathy towards the loss. You blame the father for not being there. Then you blame the president. You know, see, you blame, and blaming the father then translates into not being, wanting to be with the system. It brings an antipathy towards order, towards stability, towards structure, and towards any hierarchical organization. And what, in fact, you become a rebel.
Yeah, sure.
So that's what happens in Fight Club, where the young men become, you see, members of this iconoclastic group that's trying to bring down all established you know, edifices.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, and also, if you're against the father or you subliminally rebel against the father, you also represent rebellion against reason, because reason is one of the attributes, you see, of the animus of the father. So then you become irrational and Dionysian and, you know, sort of libertine and uninhibited, which is what is happening a lot. Now, and this inhibition can manifest in society, as I've just said, in the forms of, like, homosexuality, punk rock, you see, all the sort of the, what you would call countercultural groups.
Sure, yeah.
you know, the Burning Man. I mean, it's endless, you know.
Yeah.
You only have to go to Berlin to take a look at it, but there's plenty of it. So the this is then the idea that the master is missing and we can now do what we want.
Yeah. There's
a certain amount of, yeah, freedom in that, that you can become libertine and uninhibited. Mm. But at the same time, man needs the structure.
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing is that the drive against reason and against science, against, you know, a normative, controlled sort of world and environment, you sometimes people, you know, show that very obviously, and we know them as rebels.
Yeah.
But your average middle-class person is not going to want to show that openly.
Mm.
In fact, he won't even want to admit it to himself that he's burning with all of this anger towards God and towards the missing father.
Yeah.
So what does he do? He compensates, Henrik, by an overcompensation towards Orthodox religion.
Hmm.
You know, in other words, he gives his rebelliousness, or the instinct for rebellion, he must give it a cover, a disguise, in order to pretend that it's not there, both to himself and to the world. So I then think there's something very amazing in that exactly at the same time as war breaks out in the Gulf, war, you know, America declares war, the war on terror, which I've always said is a psychological phenomenon, at the same time as, you know, comes along with a new rise of a wave of religious fervor and fever.
Sure, yeah.
And the, and it's very dark as to why that is. And Fight Club picks up on this because if the religious zeal is, in fact, a cover for a deep disenchantment and a deep sense of anger and hatred that is partly being processed through war, and I go into this a lot on the 2012 DVD, the whole elaborate details of it.
Yeah.
If that is the case, and that the religious fervor that's sweeping America is just a cover, just a ruse, not that the people will understand it. But in many video clips that I've shown and many other video clips that I have, all the evangelists talking on stage, you will notice that they're very angry.
Yeah, yeah.
You only have to watch it. There's tremendous anger and just hatred pouring out of them, but it's slightly, you know, sublimated.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look into the message of what movies like Fight Club and these other transgressive movies are telling us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that, look, it might in fact be a fact that because we now we have war on one hand, open regression, open aggression.
Mm-hmm.
We have tremendous iconoclasm, transsexualism, and libertinism rampant in the world, especially amongst the young, because for obvious reasons they'll take that road.
Mm-hmm.
And at the other side, we've got this huge amount of you know, religious returning to these very old, established paradigms in mass. Taken together, man, those three things is not very pleasant to look at because they're telling you that really it's over. Society, civilization is crumbling.
Yeah.
And, if you look at the movie Fight Club, you'll find that there's no real solution there. Because the society is schizoid, and the character of Fight Club is unfortunately schizoid.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not even aware that, you know, he's a double person.
Exactly, yeah.
And he wakes up in a lunatic asylum at the end when the whole thing's over, you know.
Yeah.
So whether people like or don't like the movie, just let's look at the, you know, idea here that what is the movie about? Aggression. Right, Fight Club. It's about deep men who are now sick of their masculinity, and it's a good thing. I mean, you do need to go through that phase where the guy beats himself up in the office of his boss. Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
What is that? That's saying I am leaving your stupid, pathetic little roles. I don't no longer want to be shuffling these papers. I no longer want to be this, you know, buttoned down person in prison by this role.
Yeah.
So I've always said that that's fine. Being able to know what you don't want to do, knowing that you want to get out of this straitjacket, is one thing. And there may be a period of aggression while you break out of that shell.
Yeah.
But you may be caught in that aggressive mode all from then on if you don't have a more holistic understanding that when you break out of the role, where do you go?
Exactly.
You know, and American Beauty talks about this. The film American Beauty, you know, which is, again, a very transgressive film since the narrator in that movie is dead.
Mm.
I love it.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
right.
Fantastic. Yeah. The narrator of the movie is not even alive.
Yeah.
You know, what a fantastic idea. The Fight Club, too, that, you know, once you want to dispense with the role, because, you see, in the role, you don't deal with people. So there's a tremendous loneliness in everyone.
Yeah.
Because in the role, you don't deal with people at all. You're dealing role to role.
Yeah.
So when you really want to bond with somebody, you're not able to because you're dealing, you're bonding with a role.
Hmm.
Only a person can bond with another person and have a full flow, what I call meaningful friendship.
Yeah, sure.
Because I despise the word relationship and will not use it. But if you're in the role, well, you can forget about meaningful friendships or relationships, because all you have is a role-to-role, you know, programmed, utterly superficial thing. Now, the character in Fight Club, you see, is sick of that.
Yeah.
He wants to step beyond the role. But in order to do that, it is not so easy. Because if you step out of the role, you know, you are now an outsider.
Yeah.
It might make it worse. It might make the fact that you're not able to bond with anyone at all. But the fact of the matter is that you're not able to bond with anyone while you're still suffering in the role.
Exactly.
Now, one of the other classic things that happen in Fight Club is when the guy thinks he's got a problem and he goes to see the psychologist, so-called, with a small p. The psychologist recommends him to go to, you know, therapy sessions to see what suffering is like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love that line, to see what suffering is like.
Hmm.
Meaning that the so-called middle-class corporate individual who just goes to work every day and who's just living, he thinks he suffers, but it's a fake suffering. It's like what George Carlin talks about. He says, you think you suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you ain't in the Biafra with a bowl watching your family dying of starvation. You know,
yeah.
That is suffering.
Yeah, it's always the comparison. Yeah, of course.
Right. I'm not downing people's individual, you know, angst, but I'm just saying, look, let's be factual about it here, that, you know, the suffering is pretty much an illusion. And in the Fight Club, they bring that up, that the guy has to go to therapy classes to basically see other people who've gone through suffering. Because he's so immune to it. You know, our societies have made us immune. And this ties in, of course, with the famous quote from Carl Jung, where he talks about that the why people don't transcend is because they avoid legitimate suffering.
Hmm.
Right? He claims that the secret of neurosis, the secret of the reason why people are neurotic and psychotic, is that they're trying to escape from what is he referred to as legitimate suffering.
Hmm.
And I want people to think about that because it's very, very important, again, tying into this connection with the darker side of yourself. No, you don't want to suffer. You don't want to look at the dark side of anything. You want to go and medicate yourself.
Sure.
You know, you want sweet drinks to sweeten your life because you can't look at anything that's unsweet.
Hmm.
You know, and the media knows exactly how to sell you that whole idea, and that's what we're living in. We're living in an escapist aspect because we're not listening to those voices within ourselves.
Sure.
And that's what the character in Fight Club is doing. But here's the thing. Because the person is so trapped inside the roles and doesn't have any relationship or bonding with anyone, the only way that he can find that bonding then is through fighting.
Hmm.
Because when he meets his alter ego, right, the Brad Pitt character, whose name in the movie is, what was it?
Jack something?
No, Jack is the narrator, right?
Oh, okay, yeah, that's right, yeah. Hmm. Tyler Durden.
That's it.
Yeah.
Tyler is his auntie, his alter ego. And the first thing that basically Tyler is telling him is, hit me as hard as you can.
Yeah.
Right, that became an important line.
Sure.
Hit me as hard as you can, meaning the only relationship that you're capable of somebody is a violent reaction. Now, in Fight Club, they make it physical violence.
Sure.
But as people who've been following what we have been saying on our shows here, is that, wait a minute, you don't have to be having punch-ups.
Exactly, yeah.
To make it violent.
Yeah.
All human relationships are intensely violent in my looking at it. And Fight Club really is a fantastic film because they're literally showing that, you know, you want a relationship with me? Let's fight. You know, because it's only a physical, masculinized, very brutal, there's no feeling left.
Exactly.
There's no sensitivity left in our corporate world, in our society, in this utterly preposterous, you know, fake.
It's to me, it's like down to the cellular level. It's like a stimulus response kind of communication.
Yeah, and you may ritualize it, you know, and it may have its own, you know, within ritual societies, you know, fighting, conflict, or any kind of ritual, you know, sparring has an aspect of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
But in this movie, you see it becomes like the main thing. It's the main bonding concept.
Mm, yeah.
And women might say, oh, well, that's because it's a movie all about men. You know, of course, if he came to a women's circle, it would be all different. Well, maybe, but, you know, there's violence on all sorts of levels.
Yeah, there is.
You know, and women are capable of psychic violence just as much as men are capable of physical violence. So, you know,
we
got to look into those questions because it's not just so simple as saying, you know, as many critics have criticized the film, go, well, that's just a male pipe dream issue there, you know.
Yeah,
we're not talking about men. We're talking about the masculine principle.
Mm.
And believe me, the masculine principle is very, very pronounced in women also. So this is a very, very universal concept here.
Yeah.
But I just really thought that was a very powerful, you know, idea. And this idea of breaking out of the roles is what you see in the movie All About Schmidt. Where this guy has now become completely useless because, you know, he's got old. America doesn't recognize you if you pass, you know, 40 or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm. So, and his wife has died and he's pretty much, you know, what do I do with my life now that I'm, you know, past the insurance sell-by date?
Yeah.
And the guy becomes a drifter. You know, he literally becomes a drifter and goes through all these really interesting experiences. I really adore that film.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. But he's become redundant. A vanilla sky, you see the same thing as, you know, that they're telling you that the whole of your universe, the whole world that you live in, is a world that is projection of your own consciousness.
Yeah.
Meaning of your ego consciousness. So at the end, the movie is like, can I escape from myself? Can the ego break through its own production?
Yeah.
And maybe is death the only way that that can be done?
Hmm.
You know, the one criticism that I have of Da Vinci Code, just while we're having this recorded, is, and it's just, again, a very, very personal critique. It is that Robert Langdon, you know, obviously he's a teacher in symbolism, and the movie opens in which he's going around the world teaching about religious symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting, brilliant subject. You know, I teach it on it myself. But in the movie, of course, and in the story, they just had to make him Professor Langdon of Harvard.
Hmm.
You know, and that has got to go. That is probably, you know, before we even, you know, even before we would critique the whole content of the movie, to me that is just not happening. You know, the fact that makes it very bourgeois, that film. You know, because the movie is literally saying it's only legitimate to talk about, you know, secret society symbolism or even spiritual symbolism or religious symbolism if you've got a degree from Harvard. Like,
absolutely.
You've jumped through all the hoops and you're a man of the establishment.
Of course, yeah.
Well, listen, Henrik, you know from the people you've interviewed on your show, and we know absolutely from the world, that when it really comes down to it, there ain't no people from Harvard and Princeton who are even remotely interested in this subject in any kind of controversial way. And
yeah.
In fact, the people who are really pushing the envelope in the subjects of symbolism, people like Jordan Maxwell and others, are way off the grid.
Yeah.
All right, they ain't jumped through no damn hoops.
No.
So it would have been so much more an interesting film had they made this person an individual, you know, an ordinary maverick writer, very much as you see in the movie called Devil to the Devil a Daughter, which was based on it was with Richard Widmark, based on, it was a horror movie, you know, based on the writings of Dennis Wheatley, you know, in which he's an occult expert. A very good film, To the Devil a Daughter, with Christopher Lee and Natasha Kinski. You know, and that guy, the hero, is an ordinary writer, a maverick writer, who you very much see as just an ordinary self-made man. So I really couldn't stand that particular aspect, that here's Mr. Normal, you know, nothing to be, a very conventional, very establishment, you know.
Yeah.
You know, obviously it was in the original book, but I really don't know why. I think that's going to lose the younger generation. Literally, that's not a happening image. You need to really, you know, that sells the movie to a certain class of people, and it would have been so much edgier.
Yeah.
And what is the movie about? The guy is, you know, basically comes up against the law through the whole movie. He's either running from the French police or he's running from the British police the whole way through the movie. Well, then why not go the whole hog and make it so that he's such a, you know, he himself is not an establishment figure at all.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that he's coming from nowhere, you know, and he's more of an iconoclast. He's an anti-establishment system. Person would have emphasized the fact that that's why he's also being hunted by Opus Dei and the police and all of that.
Yeah.
So that was one major, you know, critique that I have. It's just to show that very establishment figure, male figure, you know, degreed, lettered, and then he's into symbolism. Almost like you have to be that to be interested in the legitimate study of symbolism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Joseph Campbell came from, you know, Princeton or Cornell or whatever it was. Fine, there's one good example. But when you're dramatizing it, you know, let's understand one thing. That, you know, even in movie makers like Spielberg and Lucas, you know, these are not people they came from nowhere. It's more of a non-mainstream subject matter, really. It's an underworld, underground thing. People come to my talks and lectures, people that I find who are into symbolism, they're way off the grid. People are not into the establishment at all.
Sure, sure. I mean,
the Robert Langdon character would have been way, way better had they, you know, made him more of a iconoclast, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's at this point it's about avoiding, you know, going through that indoctrination period. That's why people are, you know, being able to break free from the grid in that sense, and that's it. What's in most cases that is what makes people brilliant, because they don't have, you know, gone through the regular indoctrination education. So.
Right, and that's why you see there's all the difference in the world between a transgressive movie like Fight Club. You know, in Fight Club they're dealing with a Thanatos instinct. Remember we talked about that when you're committed to the inauthentic life, then the only way to break you from that is the Thanatos instinct, your inner desire for annihilation.
Sure, yeah, I remember.
You know, in Fight Club, you have a brilliant quote where it says, "In nothing is static, even the Mona Lisa is falling apart."
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
You know, this catabolic, I've talked so much in my life and taught about this, that there is your whole Eros versus, you know, Thanatos. And in the Da Vinci Code, you see, it's all establishment. It's selling an establishment message. And when I see a breach like that, it stands out to me like a sore thumb. You know, I want to know why. I want to know why. The author obviously was shocked. The film people are as well, the scriptwriter. Why did they do that? You know, there's a reason for that. It's not just put in their there by accident. Yeah. They know they could have made, you know, like the Nicolas Cage character in the National Treasure is so much more rebellious. He's like the kind of character that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his family were ridiculed all their life
mm-hmm.
because they believed in the Templar treasure, you know?
Sure.
He just hasn't been able to work it as a sort of a university-type graduate. He's basically hanging out with what looks like mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Sean Bean character is like this way-out mercenary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, sort of maverick, gun-running type of, you know, assassin type.
Sure, sure.
Because like Nicolas Cage character is hanging with a bunch of, you know, real underworld characters.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself is sort of real off the grid. That I think, is perfect. You know,
yeah.
That really worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I don't like about National Treasure is the same critique I also have about the Da Vinci Code. And that is that in the ending of the movie, the rewards are material only.
Mm, yeah.
Okay? People
sure.
need to focus on this. In drama, in film in general, film criticism people know this, it's very, very important to see what's called transcendence, that the characters go through a catharsis and they don't end up at the end of the dramatic piece, like a book, a story, or a play, or a movie. The character's not meant to be the exact same character psychologically or emotionally as they were at the beginning of the movie when you met them.
Yeah.
Now, if you really watch Da Vinci Code and National Treasure properly, there is no psychological or emotional development in any of the characters. Not one. The rewards that they get for their code cracking and their symbolism efforts are purely material.
Yeah.
In National Treasure, boy gets girl.
Yeah.
Gets Ferrari, nice house. And movie ends.
And
of course, he does vindicate. He succeeds in vindicating his family's legacy a little bit, but that's just pure vengeance. That doesn't represent, you know, an emotional transition.
Mm.
In the Da Vinci Code, hell, they don't even know what to make of the fact that they find out that the woman is, you know, descended from Jesus Christ. They're standing outside Rosslyn Cathedral, and he's basically throwing some, you know, purely, you know, off-the-cuff, very, very, almost trivial advice to her.
Mm.
They're sitting there sort of mulling it over. Now we know you're, you know, a living descendant of Jesus.
Mm.
Wow, that's really interesting, I guess. And they throw a bunch of a very trite sort of, you know, banter.
Yeah, yeah.
About what that may or may not mean. Not one of them has gone through any catharsis or emotional. It's so cold. The ending is so cold, so unrealistic.
Mm.
And this is again tells me about the mindset of the makers of this movie.
Yeah.
They're not really people who understand the mystical tradition. And even though the character in the Da Vinci Code is into symbolism. There's all the world of difference between being Lee, right, played by the Ian McKellen character, and all the difference between being the Robert Langdon character, both of whom are into symbolism, and being Leonardo da Vinci, who was into symbolism, who painted pictures that will blow your bloody mind. So taking the movie apart that way, Henrik, it's like, okay, wait a minute, you've got these so-called experts in symbolism who don't understand anything about symbolism.
Yeah.
As the movie clearly shows you, that those who journey into the realm of symbols, who use symbols personally in their life, have a deep and emotional transition. So in fact, if you watch the movie again, bearing in mind what I'm saying, you'll find that the Opus Dei characters, that's the grandfather who's found dead in the beginning with the pentacle on his chest, and the very interesting assassin character, Silas, there is where you see the emotion. Deeply committed, deeply, you know, passionate. So there's a very interesting twist in the movie that the people who actually are the ones showing emotion, transcendence, human development, love even, the killers in the movie, are the sort of dark ones of Opus Dei, you know. Just watch what they say about Silas. Just watch the little clips of his, you know, past, you know, and how he sacrificed himself to, you know, save the bishop who's being attacked and all of these kinds of things.
So,
you know, very moving. How come they didn't have that type of that type of emotion connected with the main protagonist of the movie?
But do you think that this could be a conscious move from their part, or just unconscious?
I think it was a total, utterly misreading.
Okay.
Unprofessionalism. I think that the people who wrote the scripts have the faintest idea about true symbolism in this case, and you know, they hogged the script probably, and they didn't really look into this. I mean, it could be conscious. I just think it's such a tremendous oversight. Here you have a female character who's excellent character, not a single missed scene in the film, no wasted dialogue. And yet, you know, all these pieces that cinematically are put there, some fantastic acting by every one of them, very minimalistic acting by the Robert Langdon, who's that guy, the actor?
What's his name?
Forrest Gump.
Sure, Tom Hanks, yeah.
Tom Hanks' acting is fantastic, a very sensitive, minimalistic acting.
Mm.
Of course, the French cop, you know, the Lafarge or whatever his name is, very famous French actor, brilliant in the role. The female actress is excellent.
Mm.
And her name being Sophie connects to Sophia.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
You know, the whole, very, very interesting in the names that these people are being called.
Yeah.
Shows you a lot. But again, let's not analyze the actual content of the movie. We'll have to probably do that another time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't know. I think that was such an oversight to have such strong characters, and yet, again, fatally. And this is done in many, many movies. It's a very big problem.
Mm.
It's a very common in Hollywood movies. It's not common in European movies. In European movies, there's a tremendous transformation. If you watch the movie Educators, oh my God, it's just incredible.
Hmm.
You know, the transition that these young people go through after the ordeal that they go through. You watch Lord of the Rings, a guy, look at Sam and Frodo crawling on all fours,
yeah,
burning out their energy, totally going through the underworld, coming out utterly wasted,
yeah,
on their journey. Gollum, you know,
yeah,
going through all this heartache,
hmm,
and the tremendous catharsis of the main characters.
Yeah.
Oh my God, how do you compare that? You know, that's symbolism. That's, yeah, real symbolism.
Yeah.
So here's a movie that's meant to be about Da Vinci and Botticelli, you know, and Titian and Raphael and the Christian church and the Catholic church. And you find out that in the movie, they do show you the emotion where it's due, but it's in these so-called assassin-type people.
Hmm.
Now, that makes them look more real. Now,
yeah,
that, in a way, you know, that makes them, in fact, you could sort of identify with them a lot. I think that Silas is one of the most interesting characters in the whole thing.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was reaching for there, that might be the case, that you know, they want you to identify with the murderers in that.
Of course, I talked about that with my brother, you know, and yeah. When you, if I jump back, you know, if I put my conspiracy hat on,
yeah,
then we're looking at that.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we are looking definitely at something that this movie has been made by,
mm,
you know who.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, of course, millions of dollars just don't come out of the pockets of ordinary people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, to get a movie made like that. So there's no doubt in my mind that Dan Brown, and I would extend that even to the people who wrote the original book back in 1982, the three people who wrote the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail.
Yeah, Bagent, Lee, and Lincoln.
Lincoln. I have always, you know, maintained that those people were funded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the very order for which they, you know, were meant to be exposing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it was very important for that order was already being exposed legitimately by legitimate,
sure,
conspiracy people.
Yeah.
So they funded three authors, and the number three also is a very giveaway, that there's three authors.
Hmm.
That's also a sort of a hallmark.
Hmm.
Excuse me, but the idea was that they would fund a red herring group,
hmm,
that they would later expose as being fraud.
Hmm.
So in other words, you create a fake story that then your own people, you know, it's so old, it's new.
Sure.
It's a classic, you know, black ops, you know, media, sort of, you know, 3 days of the Condor,
mm-hmm,
shows that. You know, this is a very clear MI5, British Secret Service strategy, in which you fund your own spin doctors, basically.
Yeah.
And then, you know, come in with another action and go, oh, but they were all proven frauds.
Hmm.
You know, even give them sort of light jail cells or put them through the courts, you, mm-hmm, know, give them sort of jail sentences and ridicule them. And then everybody goes, oh, yeah, well, I knew that anyway. Let me all forget about the Order of Zion.
Mm, yeah.
It was all preposterous lie, you know?
Exactly.
Well, very dangerous to think that way, because these people own the world, as their own movie even shows you.
Exactly. It's a perfect way to bury the mystery in that sense, and bury,
right,
the questioning of all the people, because we have already gone through the entire ordeal, you know, we're exposing these people as liars and so forth. Yeah, that's...
Well, absolutely. People again will refute and say, well, wait a minute, why would they even then go and show you a lot of these secrets? Because the movies are full of certain secrets.
Yeah,
they're secrets from your level.
Yeah.
If you're coming in from the middle class, from the middle of the street, you know, you've grown up reading I don't know what,
yeah,
you know, the rubbish that's taught to you in school, and then they throw a little symbolism,
mm,
you know, it's like, you know, oh, it's just like this mesmerism, you know?
Yeah.
Abracadabra, you know, they throw a lot of this stuff at you. And of course, in our little minuscule, you know, sterile lives, we think that's all just so bloody mysterious.
Yeah.
You don't realize, like, it's like Russian dolls. There's mystery within mystery within mystery, and these boys play it like a, you know, puppet show.
Yeah. Hmm.
They can put a mystery of this stupid thing. You know, do you know that the cult of Mother Mary is one of the most ancient cults?
Mm-hmm.
The bloodline of the Merovingian bloodline thing they're telling you, this dodge,
mm-hmm,
this red herring that it only has to do with the physical Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Sure.
You know how far back the cult of the Virgin Goddess, the one buried under the stars, goes?
Yeah. It's,
I mean, they even do hint at that movie, you know, hint at that even in the movie. In the very first scenes, he's telling you something about the antiquity of symbols.
Mm.
And by the way, Saturnian and solar symbolism is all the way through that movie from the book that he opens in the beginning where you see the symbol of Saturn, when he's standing at the podium, that identifies this movie as a creation of the Saturnian cult, by the way.
There we go.
Oh, yeah. And then secondly, a little bit later, a very, very interesting scene I want people to go back and watch is when they're escaping from the English police from the plane. They get into a black taxi, and they're hiding in the back, and the Ian McKellen character turns around and says, "The coast is clear, don't worry." And they go, "Oh, I wonder how they didn't see us." And he says a very important line that's actually not to the characters in the story, but to you, the audience. And he says, "Yes, but people very rarely see what's in front of their eyes." Now, that is a statement that immediately tells you that the next scene that's coming, you need to pay special attention to. You know, I don't want to get into all the reasons why this is, but in cinema, there's certain rules and laws that apply, if you know. It's just like the scene in Gladiator, when the character is, the gladiator, standing in the middle of the arena, and he turns around and says, "Are you entertained enough yet?"
Yeah.
Ridley Scott is making a double entendre there. The gladiator is not merely speaking to the characters in the Roman auditorium. He's speaking to you in the auditorium watching the movie.
That's magic right there.
Right. Now, that is double. The great filmmakers know how to do this, and there's elements of this within the movie Da Vinci Code. Now, the others, and then the scene that follows, well, I'm going to have to tell you what it is, but I would hope that people would go to it. As soon as they finish in the black taxi, the very next scene is a dialogue in a garden between the two bishops who are Opus Dei elites. The elder bishop comes, you know, to the other, his the less senior bishop, and as they're talking about their plans, and he's going to take his leave, the younger bishop is about to take his leave of his senior, and he gets his blessing. And the blessing is a, he marks his forehead. But if you watch the movie very carefully, he does not mark his forehead when he's saying, you know, "The blessings of God be with you." He does not mark his forehead with a cross. He marks it with an L. And this opens up the whole concept of the Illies, right? The Illies, the priesthood of the Illies.
Sure.
People don't know who they are. They need to get my Atlantis book. And in the appendices, you'll find an excerpt from a very old book about the priesthood of the Illies. You'll also find information on the number 23 that turns up in lots and lots of movies. But Illies is also one of the themes of the movie Vanilla Sky. The Ills, right? The people who freeze you and keep you alive, you know, for the future. That company's called the Ills. Ellis, right? So Ellis Island, the Illies, the Ills, the whole idea of, you know, the archangels being called Gabriel, Uriel, you know, the L bit. Elohim, elevated. Eldar, you know. In my new book on the Irish origins of civilization, we go very much into what the Eldar, the word Eldar is very important. So this L, the marking of the L, and then added to with the rest of the solar symbolism and the Saturnian symbol, because the symbol of L was the old word for Saturn. As you know. So again, watch out in Da Vinci Code when people are watching it again. Bear in mind this scene. And McKellen is just telling you beforehand, people very rarely see what's in front of their eyes. And that, it jumped out at me and went, okay, better be very cautious now. You know, it's just like in the movie National Treasure, the whole fantastic part where they incorporate the 322 number. They're looking on the dollar bill, remember, the church tower that's on your dollar bill, and they see that the time on the clock tower is 222.
I can remember that right away, but continue.
Remember, they're searching for the treasure, and one of the clues turns out to be that the clock tower on the dollar bill is a clue. Because that clock tower actually exists in Washington. It was one of the sites of, you know, the Liberty Bell tower. So they go physically to the Liberty Bell. Very, very interesting scenes, a lot of action, excellent scenes. And the three of them turn up at the, again, three, you know, the idea of three searchers, three seekers. Very Masonic. So they go to the area where Washington, or excuse me, it was Franklin, or had buried his clues. And it turns out that they work out that because of daylight savings time, it's not 2:22 anymore, it's 3:22.
Ah, there we go,
Now, here we go with the big, you know, skull and bones. Masonic, Atomist. Symbol 3:22. And so, of course, they go up to the clock tower, and there's a whole symbolism there about 3:22. And when it's 3:22, when it actually becomes 3:22 p.m., a shadow is cast from the clock tower to a window where they then know to find the Masonic brick. So very intricate, very interesting, and brilliantly done scenes. You know, very excellent acting by everybody involved. Really highly recommend that movie, National Treasure, to those who've, you know, not seen it. Because a lot of people, you know, will be turned off on these movies just because they're Hollywood, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's not right. I mean, don't go and see The Omen and, you know, God's sake, bypass Superman 2 or whatever, you know, Superman Returns or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but some movies are very intriguing, and let's always remember that these movies do change people's lives and get them into subject matter that, you know, you may never have heard of before.
They do. I mean, one thing, because you mentioned 23 before, a new movie out with Jim Carrey called The Number 23. Have you seen it?
No, but somebody emailed me on the blog about it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I put up, I think, a clip. The Number 23 has also been used recently in the last lot of weeks in a new Dr. Pepper advertisement.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so if people go to my blog and go to the symbolism link,
yeah,
you'll see a bunch of links to various commercials and other information. Notice the one that says, you know, divide 2 by 3. You know, there's a link there to the commercial for Dr. Pepper. Now, we've already analyzed in the DVDs that Dr. Pepper is nothing more than Satan.
Yes.
The devil, Peppa.
Yeah.
Right? And then now we got 23, which, of course, if you divide 3 into 2, it makes 0.666.
Exactly, yeah.
So they've got this whole Dr. Pepper movie commercial dripping with satanic symbolism. It's just right in your face, you know.
Yeah.
Although the point is it's not in a lot of people's places. It really is not seen yet by a lot of the world. So there's a great deal of, you know, need for people to still wake up and really understand just how deep and intricate the symbolism is,
yeah,
and how the language of symbolism and the language of words and the language of, you know, so let's definitely, you know, mention Jack Coetzee. People need to go to his website, The Brave New World.
Yeah, he's a wonderful, I hope to have him back on the show soon, too, Jack.
Right.
He's a brilliant, you know, a brilliant mind.
Isn't it? And, you know, he's on to that in a big way, you know. Picking up from some of the work I've done, but, you know, taking it even further.
Absolutely.
Show emphasis on the mushroom cult.
Yeah.
Which is a Dionysian cult that is referenced a lot in these movies subliminally. He's done work on the 9/11, the Twin Towers. His work on showing, what I particularly like about what he's done, he's shown that Manhattan with the two towers is a very old Masonic symbolism going back to what's called the primordial mound.
Yeah.
You know, and the development of the Egyptian primordial mound used to have upon it towers, two candelabra or two tall obelisks.
Sure.
And the Manhattan was again designed just like Washington D.C. is. You know, absolutely brilliant analysis there. So
yeah.
I really recommend people paying every day or every couple of days, you know, come to my blog, go over to Jack Coetzee's blog, and always be reminding, you know, yourself of how the symbolism works. And then send us stuff. You know, people send me stuff from all around the world. People go, you know, oh, how do you get so much information? You know, a lot of it's great. A lot of it's due to, you know, people who are into what we're doing here.
Yeah.
From as far away as Australia, you know, and South America, Colombia, Chile, you name it, Canada.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a country in the world, Sweden, Finland, you know, sending me to, look, I found this in my local neighborhood. You know, you have stuff right there in, you know, I mean, just right there in Gothenburg, you know.
Mm-hmm, Gothenburg, yeah.
In Gothenburg, sure. The way they've designed the, I think you pronounce it the Konserthuset?
Konserthuset, yes.
Oh, I'm pronouncing it terribly, yeah. Konserthuset. But, you know, the design of that particular area down there is highly Masonic, you know.
Yep, indeed.
heavy duty, you know.
Yeah.
Stands out a mile.
Tremendous. I mean, and that's the kind of idea also that I like very much, that people all around the world, you know, can contribute. And when we start, you know, in that sense, working together and, you know, incorporating these different ideas and notifying each other about these different news items and what's going on in the world and so forth, it is like we are creating our own little network, you know, in that sense, loose network of you know, which basically will help us to keep track of all this, you know, all of this stuff, which is excellent. That's the main idea here. That's the purpose, to grow and learn from each other, all of us here. So
because we're all making the movie together.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, if you want to see, it's like Buckminster Fuller said, if you want to replace a rotten system, you know, you don't just destroy that system. You build something to replace and outlive the existing system. And this is not an area for egotism. You know, like, for instance, when I taught the children in California, and when we showed lots of stuff, I mean, we showed lots of movies, especially tons and tons of commercials,
mm-hmm.
but there was a lot of Prisoner. There was a lot of series called Blake 7,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know if people have heard of, but we showed that to the kids. They really liked that, especially the very rare first episode of Blake 7, which is, pretty much a collector's item.
Mm-hmm.
A stunning episode there about the drugging down of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
I learn more from those kids' responses the stuff that, you know, I've been studying symbolism since I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
Non-stop. I mean, dedicatedly, hard, you know, every day looking at magazines, you know, keeping magazines and, you know, using the magnifying glass and studying everything, you know, that had to do with subliminals.
Yeah.
And I learned more from listening to the children talking about what they were seeing than I'd ever done on my own.
Yeah.
About what they were seeing and what they thought certain things were,
yeah.
and even about the way that it was working on their minds, and more importantly, alternative ways to do it. Because again, I'm not against media. I'm not against television.
Yeah.
You know, I'm for it. It's just what comes across it.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm fantastic movies like One Hour Photo, Hellboy. You know, I mean, I'm absolutely, you know, a fan of this kind of thing, especially Lord of the Rings and other movies that I would say were my personal favorites. You know, I mean, we didn't want to go into what my personal favorite movies are. You know, that's a whole other subject. But you know, again, the medium is very important.
Yeah.
And we are in our, you know, this is the age and the generation in which we pick up cameras. You know, look at YouTube and look at Google, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And go out and make your own little shows and upload them. Or, you know, people are sitting there showing how to work out guitar pieces, you know, and showing off their own talents and skills. This is a fantastic age.
Yeah, it is.
You know, where you can bypass all this jive that tells you, oh, you can't do this and you can't do that and, you know, you're not good enough and all that jive, you know.
Exactly.
And that's all been embodied by people.
Hmm.
When we were working at the school with the children, symbolism, every week, I could not believe the amount of stuff that they were bringing into me. Wrappers, packages, you know, shopping bags, clips, cuts, you know, stuff that's cut out of magazines, subliminal stuff that they'd observed. Because one person barking this truth is not going to happen. People will refute you. They'll think you're a crank.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you have a community of people going, I believe you. I see it in my own thing. They've just built this thing in my town. Or look what they're advertising over here.
Exactly.
Somebody just sent me a clip, you know, from an English newspaper saying, politician asked for New World Order because of global warming.
Yep.
New World Order required to stop global warming.
I got the article up on my site now. This is the Brown, I can't remember his surname. I think it's Brown.
He's bending over backwards. He can't sleep at night. He's so worried about global warming. And he's come up with a brilliant idea. It's called the New World Order. Everybody get in line.
Yeah.
We can't handle it ourselves. And we certainly can't let independent nations deal with it.
Yeah.
Tribal unions and federations. And we certainly can't allow, you know, America to be a democratic republic anymore where each state rules its own state.
No,
because
we need
it knows its own needs. No. We have to have a new world order.
Total control grid with surveillance cam and a microchip population. That's where we're
going to
have to
Jacob.
Go. Yeah.
Under Jacob. Under the Jacobs. You know. under the whole Atenist. Oh my God! It's just unbelievable. You know. So again, we are now inventing. And I do believe that the subversion of this idiotic, you know, conformist Orwellian nightmare is going to end.
Yeah.
I do believe that it's just because, let's put it this way, let's use the Da Vinci Code as an example. If you're a believer that which I'm not, by the way, but if you're a believer that the Priority Scion is just this wonderful, highbrow family, like they show you in Rosalind at the end, of well-meaning people who have been keeping this secret alive, and they're just such the most darling, highbrow, intellectual class of people who are hard-pressed by the evil Vatican. You know, even from that movie, if you were a member of the Priority Scion, you would say that, listen, we have developed a very, very deep symbolic code. We've got into symbolism. We've learned how to hide ourselves. We've learned how to be, you know, work without being seen. And the reason is because we had an adversary that was pursuing us. Right? So if you take my meaning, it's like groups develop their own artistic genius, their own brilliance, their own sophistication, because you have an adversary who's after you.
Yeah.
V is the same message, that the man's skills, his brilliance, his covertness, you see, is because he knows he's been hunted by every police force. You know, you can imagine he's literally on the wanted list.
Yeah.
So his skill, his genius, his uniqueness, his idiosyncrasy has come from the fact that he's a pursued person. Well, take it back to what I've been saying now about society.
Yeah.
The rebels, the outsiders, the people who absolutely know that we're being shot at, there's something severely evil going on in this world, are, whether they know it or not, like little earthworms, you know, developing the alternative way.
Yeah.
It's part of it. You don't get it because everything's rosy. You get it because because there's something breathing down the back of your neck that won't let you live. Out of that system, you slowly create, you see, a new pattern, a jigsaw of different ideas. It may not be community. It may not be, you know, going and living in these communities, because that hasn't worked. Well, it may not be that. So don't limit it.
Yeah.
You know, don't say, oh, it's going to be this. It'll take that form. It'll be groups of really cool hippie. You know, the hippies tried that. It didn't work. So, you know, maybe it's not going to take that form.
Yeah.
It could be any number of things. So don't limit what's going to happen. Certainly don't get into frustration and feed it with your powerful so-called negative energies. First of all, they're not negative, but don't feed it with fear.
Exactly, yeah.
Or anger, because then, you know, you're like a prisoner being, no matter how he tries to get away, the ball is leading him right back to square one, you know?
Yeah, it's totally true. You know, Michael, this has turned out to be a kind of a two-hour special here today. We have, you know, nothing wrong with it. It's perfect to dedicate some time to these topics. But do you want to kind of finish off on a particular movie, or do you want to round things off right now? I mean, we could talk about, if you want, just some more about either Vanilla Sky or Apocalypto or something like that.
No, I didn't really get the chance to see Apocalypto too clearly, but... You know, we can maybe leave that for another time. I'm just curious about, I love the idea of the forest, you know, and the hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that Gibson is partly saying that, look, you know, when your society crumbles, because remember, that's what that movie is basically about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the tremendous quote from the movie is, a great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself from within.
Hmm.
So, again, that's very reflective of, you know, what's happening right now.
Mm, indeed, yeah.
That our society, as we were talking when we were speaking about Fight Club, could be on its way out.
Yeah.
Ergo, then what's the future when you step out of those roles? Apocalypto is trying to give you an idea of going back to nature and not fearing the fact that the walls break down. That could be a great liberation.
Could that be?
I've been also mentioning that in my solution, you know, aspects of my talk, that look, when you predict what's going to happen between now and 2012 and you're leaking all this fear,
mm-hmm.
why don't you see it as something actually positive, where it could be the ending of illusion?
Sure, yeah,
it could be
exactly.
The final breaking out of all this illusion that people are just so encompassed by.
Could it also be because there is now a fascination, basically, about, you know, stuff like the Maya and the Aztecs and the South American tribes over there, at this point, could this be kind of evidence in some sense that, you know, we're approaching this time also because we're kind of looking at other previous civilizations who've gone through similar periods? We're trying to pick up, you know, if we can learn something, if we can understand why this happened. Could it be a hint? That's what I'm saying here.
Yeah. It's coupled with the idea that any dark people are a shadow.
Mm-hmm.
So Gibson, you know, the sort of white establishment, you know, anyone making a movie where they don't really want to face something about themselves often psychologically projects it.
Mm.
So the darker people of the world, you know, it's that old colonialistic idea that it's them. They're the butchers. They're the evil ones, you know.
Yeah.
But bearing that in mind, still the movie works because it is a critique of America, of the Americas, of hierarchical society, of the idea that you're not spiritual in yourself. It's a priestarchy who's going to tear your heart out in the name of God.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Apocalypto, right? The idea, that's a very Christian term, that, you know, there's an ending cycle that takes place.
Yeah.
And in that ending cycle, there is schizophrenia, just utterly schizoid people walking around who are not connected to their inner being, who have no values, no morals, because they're always waiting for the priests and the teachers and you know, the system to give them those guidelines and those handrails. They have no inner compunction.
Yeah.
You know, this is, again, why I keep pondering on that interesting division in the Da Vinci Code, that the people who have the conviction and the morality and the sort of the spiritual conviction are the Opus Dei hitmen.
Hmm.
I don't know what to make of that. You know, it's like bizarre. I would have preferred to see it in the protagonists.
Sure.
And the fact that it wasn't in those protagonists is very, very disturbing to me, to have these sort of like drifting middle class, or actually in his case, he's upper middle class.
Yeah.
Actually kind of rather sterile people. You know, sort of caught up in this mystery,
yeah,
but kind of like almost themselves personality-less.
Hmm.
You know, that to me is what stood out, and maybe it was conscious, I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
You know, in Apocalypto, the idea is that there's tremendous, and you know, hostility within human beings. Human beings embody utterly, tremendously demonic forces. And that in the end, we might find that humanity... Remember, we're talking about that post-human world after 2012?
Mm, yeah, indeed.
I've always speculated that, look, no, it's not that humanity is going to be wiped out. It's that humanity won't want to be humanity. Humanity will get so sick of its own emotions, because it doesn't know how to deal with emotions, that it will then become very cybernetic and technotronic. Or it's just that human beings utterly lose their humanity within. Or that they get so sick of living amongst other people who have no soul and who are acting in a robotic way, that it's not as much a threat to feel that you should go back and live in nature, because of the two, it turns out that living amongst the nature again is even less threatening. And we're seeing this. We're seeing a lot of people live from the West even going and back, living in third world countries. There's even people of money and status who are going to Spain. And believe me, Spain is definitely a third world country, right? In eastern Spain. People are going out to Spain. You know, they're going out to India and China. Why? Because they want some feeling of humanity.
Yeah, sure.
And they want to live in a way that's tribal, you know, and close to the ground. People going to Australia, you know, and living in Africa even. There's a lot of this happening. Leaving the West because they're so sick and tired of the way that the West, quote-unquote Western, you know, system is being set up. It's just not sustainable. So my theory is this, that never ever fear what is negative, because what is negative is already sending a signal to nature and me. I am unsustainable. I can't last forever.
Yeah.
It's horrible when it's lasting, yeah, to have McDonald's and Subway, you know, and Viacom and everything in your face every day.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's not pleasant to, you know, have all that corporate rubbish. But it cannot last forever because it's built on lies.
Yeah, exactly.
And the person of truth does not fight it in an active way like that. That won't work. What you do is you educate yourself against it, you know, and you build a new system. You build a new way.
Absolutely.
Not Michael Tesorian's way, you know, I'm studying this myself. But we all come together to discover what might work here.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so excellent stuff. I totally agree with that, Michael. In case we have some new listeners for us today, tell us about your website and your DVD, excellent DVD series, so people, you know how they can, you know, support your work and get so much more of what you do.
Well, yeah, the DVD that jumps to mind is Subversive Use of Sacred Symbolism. It's the bestseller of the series, although you can buy the series as a whole unit, and you can browse the series on, it has its own website, which is originsandoracles.com, and you can go in there. There's just, you know, 22 DVDs or something, 60 hours of material, you know, and definitely focus on the one that's on symbolism, because that covers a lot of ground.
It does.
It's into
the
whole Masonic thing. It deals with the feminine concept. Deals with the manipulation of letters and the manipulation of color and the use of very, very ancient sacred symbols in a modern, you know, context of the multimedia. And it's very much focused on astrology. That a lot of the ancient symbols that are used in the mainstream today are old alchemical and astrological, or what might more correctly be called astrotheological symbolism. And this is something that you know, I wanted to stress on. Because there's a lot of people out there who've done the whole, you know, symbolism bit, you know, that Procter & Gamble, you know, they got a star, they must be evil, you know, kind of rubbish. But, you know, it's important to go way more beyond that and get into the whole Masonic messaging that's going on here. And who are these people?
Sure.
Why would they want to be doing this? And why do they name cars the Mercury, you know, or whatever?
Yeah.
There's a whole other occult understanding of symbolism.
Yeah.
If you're just into symbolism, don't bother. I'm dealing with the occult, you know, aspects of symbolism, which is a whole different subject. And again, people need to understand that before they start emailing me with all these critiques. I'm an occultist. I deal with the occult, you know, conspiratorial aspects of these subjects. I'm not talking in Harvard or Princeton, nor do I want to, getting up there talking about, you know, religious art.
Sure.
And religious symbolism in a conventional way. That's not what we're doing.
So everybody, check it out. It's originsandoracles.com, and also, of course, your personal website, michaeltesarion.com, and from there people can find your blog and all your other sites also.
Yeah, and again, on the blog we got the symbolism section, which is visited a lot, you know, and I keep all the pages on the blog updated, so if you think you've seen it already, think again, because every other day there's something new on every page of the blog, from links. You know, and of course, some of this stuff is linked to YouTube and Google, where what we link to is not there very long.
You're
going to miss it, you know, so make sure you're coming back regularly, because some of the links, you know, they appear, then they disappear. This is one of the downsides of Google and YouTube, you know. I mean, I understand it, of course, but, you know, again, if a couple of weeks go by, you could miss something really heavy, really something very interesting.
Absolutely. Okay, so we're going to finish off this segment, but... Michael, again, thank you so much for coming on and spending some time with us, and we will talk more in the subscriber section.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you, Henrik.
Thank you. We are going to continue our talk with Michael Tsarion in the subscriber section. We are going to spend some time talking about the tarot and the origins and age of it. We'll also talk about the connection to the regular card deck, and also about eschatology and Catholicism and a whole lot more. So I hope you'll join us. If you're currently not a subscriber, click on subscribe from our front page and read more about it. If you like this radio program, do consider signing up with us. This is the best way to help and support what we are doing here. The website, of course, is redicecreations.com. Stop by daily to follow along in the news, and don't forget to check out our forum. Thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren, and a big thanks to you for tuning in to the show. We will be back on Sunday again with a new program lined up. Until then, take care.